Om sahana vavatu sahanau bhunaktu sah vidyan karavavahai tejasvinavadhitamastu ma vidvishavahai. Om shanti shanti shanti. Om. Very good. Welcome to you all. Welcome also to our many students attending these classes regularly online. We continue our study of the current chapter of Uddhava Gita. Remember, we saw before that, I think two classes ago, Uddhava asked a question, how to become free from suffering. And Sri Krishna's response said, you know, your question sounds exactly like when Yudhishthira asked Bhishma how to become free from suffering. And you remember the context was after the war when Bhishma lied dying, near death, on that so-called bed of arrows. That's when Yudhishthira and all the Pandavas and Sri Krishna himself and many others, they all gathered nearby. And the words of Bhishma uttered at that time form that you'll find all of that in the Shanti Parva, the 12th book of the Mahabharata. And the last portion of that discussion is called Moksha Dharma Parva, and that's specifically the part that Sri Krishna is referring to. So Sri Krishna has been giving an overview of this Moksha Dharma Parva, which is a combination of Paroksha Jnanam and Paroksha Jnanam. Remember these terms are really, you know that I only give you Sanskrit terms that are important. Otherwise, it's too much. So Paroksha Jnanam is indirect knowledge. We can call it scriptural knowledge. What Bhishma said while he was dying to Yudhishthira and the others, that is Paroksha Jnanam. But the goal that we seek here and every time we meet, and the goal of Vedanta in general, is not this kind of Paroksha Jnanam, we'll call it scriptural knowledge. What we seek is Atma Jnanam, self-knowledge. And Atma Jnanam is not Paroksha indirect, it is a Paroksha direct knowledge. So we want to remember that very important distinction. Here, Sri Krishna has been going for a number of verses on these teachings, and he's about to end, and then he's going to shift the topic to bhakti in just a moment. But he has two more verses, and these verses concern the shortcomings of Paroksha Jnanam, the shortcomings of mere scriptural knowledge, and that's what we'll see in today's class, or in the beginning of today's class. Shruti pratyaksham aitihyam, shruti pratyaksham aitihyam, anumanam chatushtayam, anumanam chatushtayam, pramaneshvanavasthanad, vikalpat savirajyate, vikalpat savirajyate. Shrutihi pratyaksham aitihyam anumanam. Four. This chatushtayam, this group of four, are four pramanas. Pramana is a remember, actually, we didn't discuss it here. We had a long and detailed discussion on this in our Vedanta class, the Sunday Vedanta class. Pramanam is a means of knowledge, an instrument through which you gain knowledge, like your eyes are an instrument through which you gain knowledge of me sitting here. Your ears are an instrument through which you gain knowledge of what I'm saying. There are others, like anumana, which is the last of these four. Anumana means inference. When you see smoke rising on above the mountain, You say, oh, there's a fire. You infer the presence of fire from the sight of the smoke. So this anumanam is one pramana. The sense faculties are another pramana. He lists some others here. Shrutihi, scripture, is a pramana. And by the way, our context here in calling, in referring to scripture, Sri Krishna is focusing on the karmakanda of the scripture, which means the part of the scripture that tells you what rituals you should do if you want a better rebirth, if you want to go to heaven, if you want the birth of a son, if you want the rains to come for your crops to grow. So it is the karmakanda portion of the Vedas that we're referring to. How else would you know what rituals to perform? How else would you know how to go to heaven? So Shruti is a pramana that reveals these means and ends, the means of going to heaven and the various heavens that can be achieved. Then comes pratyaksham, we've already referred to. Pratyaksham is sense perception. Sight, hearing, taste, touch, and smell are another of the four pramanas he's mentioning here. Aitihyam means tradition. And tradition here refers to what we have learned from the wise ones who have gone before. Sometimes this aitihyam is included in Shruti. Here it's separated from Shruti. They're both cases of authority. You can have authority in the form of a scripture. You can have an authority in the form of a person. So when authority is in the form of a scripture, we call it Shruti. When authority is in the form of a person or a tradition of people, a lineage of people, we call that Aitihyam. And the last of these four is Anumanam. In Advaita Vedanta, we actually acknowledge a total of six pramanas. Aitihyam is included in Shruti, and Anumanam has several subdivisions. We won't go into all these details. If you're interested in that, the last week's class in the Upadesha Sahasri. Go and look at last week's class. We saw this in great detail. So these are the four pramanas. All of them. Interesting. If Shruti refers to only the karmakanda, which of these four pramanas gives you a paroksha jnanam, direct knowledge, atmajnanam, knowledge of your true self? Again, Shruti referring only to the karmakanda. The jnanakanda we know. The jnanakanda gives you a kind of paroksha jnana that you can use for the sake of gaining a paroksha jnana. We can say that the jnanakanda is like a finger pointing, and that finger points at something. If I point at, Suresh sitting there nicely taking care of the slides and the AV equipment. So if I point at Suresh, you look at him and you gain knowledge through the pointer. So the jnanakanda is full of these pointers, pointing not at Suresh, obviously, pointing at your true nature. That's in the karma, in the jnanakanda, not the karmakanda, which points at heaven. If I point at heaven, will you see it? If I point at Suresh, you get direct knowledge of Suresh. If I point at heaven, you don't get direct knowledge. You can see the distinction. So none of these four pramanas give direct knowledge of your true nature as Satchidananda Atma. Therefore, how valuable are they? Well, if you want to enjoy a worldly life, then they're valuable. So through Shruti, you come to know how to go to heaven. Through this Aitihya, give a funny example, learning from an authority. You hear a news report that a certain road has been shut down due to an accident or something, and you don't travel by, and you choose not to take that road. That's an example of vaitichyam. You learned about something from a person who is an authority. Anumanam we use all the time, and more importantly, science uses all the time. Science is basically anumanam plus mathematics is science, and it's improved the quality of our lives so much. And I skipped over pratyaksham, which is pretty obvious, our five senses. All of that is connected to the world, and we've discussed again and again and again how perfect contentment and peace is not available merely through worldly pursuits. We get little kicks now and then. There are plenty of fun things to be achieved in our worldly lives, but none of those things culminate in complete peace, perfect, unbroken contentment. Never. That's why Sri Krishna concludes here, pramaneshu anavastat vikalpat. Vikalpat, vikalpa, that which is, literally that which is projected. Here, that which is created. What is created? The world is created. So vikalpat, from this created world, which is pramaneshu anavastat, from this created world, which is avastha is that which is established. Unavastha, what is not established. And what is not established, obviously, is the true source of contentment and peace. So through these pramaneshu, the first word here, through these four pramanas, whatever is established through these particular four will not lead you to perfect peace and contentment. It is worldly things that are revolved, that are, interesting. I usually don't have difficulty speaking, but today is a little bit of a rough day. So if I misspeak, when do you hear me mispronounce? You hear me use wrong words all the time. I misspeak, I use wrong words. I usually don't have problems with pronunciation. So we'll see how today's class goes. Okay. So even this anavastat just wouldn't come out. Okay. So here, and by the way, I'm absolutely fine. It's just this dizziness thing, like always. It's absolutely non-threatening. It's just a nuisance. So continuing. Sri Krishna says in the second half that these pramanas, these four pramanas, will empower you to enjoy the world, but these four pramanas will not lead you beyond that. So this is a limitation of worldly gains. Now you might think, well, what about other worldly gains, going to heaven? After all, scripture isn't confined to worldly things. Some of it is. You want the rains to fall? You should do this ritual. You want the birth of a child? You should do that ritual. So some of the scripture is concerned with worldly things, but mostly it's concerned with going to heaven. So you might argue, well, wait a minute. What about going to heaven? Aren't those scriptures useful for going to heaven? Interesting. Sri Krishna says no. What's the point of going to... What an amazing teaching. What we'll see in the next verse is Sri Krishna argues against the value of going to heaven. Really? Let's see. Karmanam parimanitvat. Karmanam parinamitvat. Avirinchara mangalam. Avivinchara mangalam vipaschinashwaram pashyet vipaschinashwaram pashyet adrishtam api drishtavata. karmanam. We have to add some words here. Karmanam and was, means of karma, and we're talking about the results of karma, actions. The results of karma, Sri Krishna says, skip ahead to the next line, and amangalam. What bold words. The results of actions end up being amangala, inauspicious. In what sense are efforts, actions inauspicious? In this context, they do not produce perfect contentment and peace. No matter how hard you try, you say, oh, you're not trying. Have you ever been told you're not trying hard enough? Especially if you're trying to learn tennis or something like that. Your coach will say, try harder. Well, how hard should you try to gain perfect peace and contentment? To reach a state of perfection, you better be ready to make an infinite effort. Are you ready for that? Well, if you're not ready to make an infinite effort, we have to recognize the insufficiency of worldly deeds. And here Sri Krishna points to a more technical problem. He says, parinamatvat, because the results of those worldly deeds are, parinama means actually, parinama, one meaning is changing, and that's the most common meaning. But we can also get another meaning, and that is limited, measured. The root ma means to be measured. Whatever you can achieve through worldly life has a measure. Small effort, you've heard me say this. Small effort, small result. Medium effort, medium result. Big effort, big result. Meaning for an infinite result, a perfect result, uninterrupted contentment and peace forever and ever, that result would require an infinite effort, which is simply not possible. Therefore, he says that the results of action, karmanam, results of all actions, amangalam, is inauspicious. He says, avirinchat. Virincha is a kind of an obscure word for brahmaji. And here the reference is to Brahmaloka. Even going to Brahmaloka, suppose you use that scriptural pramana, the scriptures, and you did all the rituals, and you made it to Brahmaloka. I suppose Brahma, I'm smiling because you know our Christian friends make jokes of what happens when you get to heaven, and you're met by, I think they say you're met by the Archangel Gabriel at the gates of heaven, and he says, congratulations, you made it. So when you make it to Brahmaloka, I suppose you're going to meet Brahmaji. What will Brahmaji say? Namaste, aye, padhariye. Welcome to you, please come in. Something he'll say. Anyway, I'm making a stupid joke. Forgive me. Just for some fun. Sri Krishna's point here is Brahmaloka is held to be the highest heaven, the highest otherworldly attainment possible. And he says even that is parinama. Even that is limited, finite, because you go, as we've discussed before, you go to heaven by virtue of your accumulated good karmas. Those accumulated good karmas are finite. Therefore, your time hanging out with Brahmaji and his loka, your time will be finite. Therefore, amangalam. On the other hand, last half, on the other hand, vipashchit, one who is wise. One who is wise, pashyet, sees, understands that adrishtam, in the next line, is nashvaram. Adrishtam is a technical word for the results of karma. You don't see the results of karma. You see the results of your worldly deeds, you do not see the results of doing rituals, the accumulated good karmas. So those ritualistic, the results of rituals are adrishtam, and they are nashwaram, expendable. Expendable, drishtavat, just like seen results. Everything, any result is expendable. Let me explain that word. Why should, that's an odd word. Why expendable? The result of going to work all week is a paycheck. What do you do with your paycheck? You spend it. Your paycheck is expendable. The results of your worldly activities are expendable, and in exactly, not exactly, in the same way. The results of doing rituals are equally expendable. Just like your paycheck, the enjoyment you have in this heavenly domain consumes, as it were, that that good karma. So with this verse, Sri Krishna ends with some pretty pointed criticism of this paroksha jnanam. And what do you receive in college? Does anyone help you gain atmajnanam in college, in university, in your postgraduate studies? It's all focused on paroksha jnanam. All paroksha jnanam, even scriptural paroksha jnanam, is limited. What we seek, aparoksha jnanam, discovery of your own true nature, which culminates in perfect contentment and peace. So the topic is over, and now we shift from this discussion about paroksha and aparoksha jnanam. We shift suddenly to bhakti. And this chapter has different parts, different sections. So the next section deals with, deals with bhakti in a very important way. Let's see that here. Bhakti yoga puraivoktaha. Bhakti yoga puraivoktaha. Priyamanayate nagha. Punashchakitayashyami. Madbhakte karanam param. All right. So he says, bhakti yoga. So this is a transition. He says, bhakti yoga pura eva uktaha. Chop up all the words. This has been discussed by me before. I've already thought, remember, this is quite a long text. I think it's about two or three times as long, twice as long, as a Bhagavad Gita. So it's a long text. And in prior chapters, this topic of bhakti has already been discussed. So Sri Krishna tells Uddhava, I've already taught it to you. I've already taught it to te in the second line. Anagha, you, O stainless one, you, the pure-hearted Uddhava, I've already told it to you. Why? Priyamanaya, because you are dear to me. You're my cousin brother, as some of you would say. Or as most Americans would say, young Americans today would say, bro. It sounds funny to me, but anyway, that's what they say. But here, having already told it, punaha cha, but once again, katayashyami, I will tell you. I will tell you what, and a very important discussion of bhakti is about to ensue, because he's going to talk about the param karanam. By the way, my translation here is not quite correct. The param should modify karanam, not mad bhakti. I will teach you the param karanam, the most effective means. Karanam here means the means. Mad bhaktehi, for gaining devotion to me. So the karanam, the means, mad bhaktehi, for gaining devotion to me. But the param karanam, the most effective means for gaining devotion to me, katayashyami, I will tell you. There's something here that we take for granted. I mentioned briefly before, and that is bhakti is discussed a lot in a lot of different ways, but sometimes not in very practical ways. In other words, what are specific practices that you can use to develop bhakti? Just an observation. Sometimes I get an email or a question, someone asking, Swamiji, how... No. In fact, this came up in a recent satsang. I got a satsang question online that asked, that referred to the fact that in a class or in a prior satsang, I made the following statement. Without bhakti alone won't make you enlightened. Without bhakti, you won't get enlightened. So that statement. Bhakti alone won't make you enlightened, but without bhakti, forget it. So the questioner was saying, if you're saying that bhakti is essential, the person apparently was struggling with this, how to cultivate that bhakti? Crucial. The means, and here the param karanam, the most effective means for cultivating that bhakti. And that is exactly what Sri Krishna is going to teach here in 1, 2, 3, 4 verses. He's going to give a variety of techniques, very practical, how to cultivate bhakti. It doesn't just come on its own. Now, some of it, and let me preface this discussion with a few comments here. One's relationship to bhakti depends tremendously on the individual person. We are all so different. Some of you were raised in families where you grew up kind of soaked in bhakti. Your parents were involved in various devotional activities. You grew up in that environment, and you just soaked it up. That's one kind of person. There are many kinds of people. We'll divide them up in just several kind of categories. Another kind of person might have come up in that same devotion-rich environment, but you know how teenagers and young adults sometimes rebel? It happens. And sometimes that rebellion is against religion. Not uncommon, especially if parents are a little over the top pushing too much on the children. It's good to bring up children it's excellent, it's wonderful, it is crucial to bring up children in a religious environment. But is it possible for parents to overdo things? Many of you know how that works. And you know, when a parent tries too hard, it often backfires, especially when the children grow to be teenagers and young adults. So if you push them too much in academics, they can rebel against that. And if you push children too much into religion, they can rebel. First category, a child who grows up in a religious environment as an adult of bhakti. Other possibility is a person who grows up in a religious environment, overly religious environment, and rejects it as a teenager or young adult, grows up with no bhakti. So many, you probably know some people. Few of you might even be like that. Uncommon. And by the way, I fall into that category. So was raised as in this Roman Catholic Church. I was extremely pious. All that was gone. I didn't wait till I was a teenager. It was gone probably long before then. Anyway, but then there's another category, yes, of children who are raised in a completely non-religious environment. And naturally, they grow up without any devotion. One category where children grow up to be adults who have a lot of bhakti, but we now have two categories of children who grow up with no bhakti. And I'm making this distinction is your whatever is your experience and whatever the three categories you might place yourself, whether you grew up in a religious environment, whether you grew up in an overly religious environment and rejected it, or if you grew up in a non-religious environment, I think that pretty much covers it, right? Mostly. Some unusual situations, but mostly. Whatever you grew up in, it's helpful to remember that not everyone is like you. We often have these blinders on where we see the world through the lens of our own experience. Whatever is your experience, in whatever category you were born, you were raised in, please don't assume that everyone is like you. Which means if you were raised in a religious environment, you shouldn't wonder why some people are so irreligious or even allergic to religion. You shouldn't wonder, you should understand. Of course, so many people are adverse to religion, and contrarywise, if you were raised in a non-religious household or if you rejected religion, you shouldn't, there's no point in looking at religious people and saying, why are they so religious? Look at this person's been fasting on a certain day their whole life. Why do they bother doing that? You know, it surprises me how sometimes even good, solid Hindus can be critical of others as being, quote, overly religious. It might not be for you, or in American English, it might not be your thing. It might not be your thing, but it might be perfectly appropriate for someone else. So this is and I'm stressing this because we make this mistake all the time of looking at the world through our own lens. We need to appreciate the individuality of others. Okay, enough said. With all of this in mind, we said one category grows up to be filled with devotion, two categories not so much. So we need a lot of work on cultivating bhakti. Many, many, many Hindus from good families and those like myself raised outside the Hindu tradition, we need a lot of help. What is it like in school, did you ever have to take remedial courses? You have to catch up, so to speak. So this is a little bit like that. We'll see that. So Sri Krishna gives us a lot of practices that can be so valuable. Let's see those practices. Shraddha mrita kathayam me, Shraddha mrita kathayam me, Shashwan maranu kirtanam, Shashwan maranu kirtanam, Parinishtha cha pujayam, Parinishtha cha pujayam, Stuti bhistavanam mama, Stuti bhistavanam. Shraddha, we have to break words apart, amrita kathayam me. Amrita katha, isn't that the name of a comic book? Is that? Amar chitra. This made me think of that comic book. Same meaning. Okay. But here, Amrita Katha, these immortal stories, or Amrita can also mean nectar, these lovely, sweet stories. What kind of sweet stories? May. The stories about me, Sri Krishna says. Remember, we're studying Bhagavata Purana, where most of those stories come in this Bhagavata Purana. So, with regard to those stories, having Shraddha in those stories. Now, we got a little problem here. If you've been paying attention, and I know you have, no doubt about that, you might be remembering, you might pay attention but not remember. So let me remind you that not long ago, I said you don't have to believe in the historicity of these stories. Did I misspeak? Sri Krishna says you should have Shraddha in those stories. And I said, you need not have historicity. You need not accept those stories as historical. If Sri Krishna were here, he would say, I don't know what language, if he spoke Hindi, ABTK. He'd say, that's what you're saying is also correct. Because Shraddha doesn't necessarily mean accepting the historicity of mythological stories. So when you read stories of Lord Shiva and Vishnu getting into a big fight, do you need to take that as historical? It happened. That fight happened on a Tuesday afternoon. The purpose of that story is to teach you something. There's a message conveyed by each and every one of these stories. So if you're going to, just to make my point very clear, suppose you accept the historicity of the story and fail to get the message. What good is that? And allow me to make a criticism here. To accept the historicity without understanding the deeper meaning makes you a fundamentalist. I'll say that again. To accept that it's true. It's true because it comes in Scripture. By the way, this is about our Christian friends and Muslim friends who accept the literal truth of their Scriptures. They accept it. They say this is the literal truth, but then they fail to understand at a deeper level. That's accepting the historicity and rejecting the teaching. To me, and you don't have to agree with me on this point, but to me, this defines fundamentalism. So if you want to accept the historicity, no problem. But you must understand the teaching. That's the whole point of the stories. So with regard to Sri Krishna, he says, having Shraddha in the stories about me. So if you accept the historicity that Sri Krishna and the gopis had a lot of fun in the forests of Vrindavan, if you accept the historicity or if you don't, in my view, it doesn't make any difference. What's important is to understand the message which is taught in those stories. And that's, I think, what Sri Krishna means here by Shraddha. Not blind faith in the historicity of these stories, but rather Shraddha being open and understanding what is being taught. This is a means for cultivating bhakti, which means, the word means is a problem in English. We have means as a way of accomplishing something and means as a meaning of something. It's very, in English, it's a very confusing word. So the point here is that the means of cultivating bhakti is these stories. When I say you need not accept them as historical truths, did I say you shouldn't read them? Did I say they're useless? In fact, I said the opposite. I said they're wonderful, they're inspiring, they're helpful, and especially when you understand their message. So, to immerse yourself in these wonderful stories, not just the stories of Sri Krishna, but all of the stories in the Puranas, including this Bhagavata Purana, the stories of in the Ramayana and Mahabharata, whether or not you accept the historicity of those stories is beside the point. Immerse yourself in those stories to absorb the teachings of those wonderful texts. So this is number one. By the way, I think there are about more than a dozen he gives here, a dozen specific practices. Number one is reading these stories with shraddha, we'll just say the proper attitude, gaining the teachings. Then next, he says, shashvat mad anukirtanam. Shashvat, always. Mad anukirtanam, kirtana, singing. Anukirtana, singing after. Singing after means what? Those of you who have studied music, you know what it is. The teacher sings, sa re ga. You sing, sa re ga. Anukirtanam. They sing, you sing after. Kirtanam, anukirtanam. Of course, here we're not talking about singing, we're talking about teachings. So the teacher teaches, and then what do you do? Anukirtanam. Now, anukirtanam could mean you pass that knowledge along, you pass it along to your children, to your friends, you become a teacher. If someone doesn't become teachers in the future, we won't have future generations of teachers. But there's another meaning. Anukirtanam could mean then to reflect on what you've been taught. Anu means after. So after the kirtanam, after the teaching. Kirtana literally means praise. So after the teaching, there is anukirtanam. Either repeating that praise or reflecting on that praise. And to do that, shashwan, continually. And that's what we do here. In fact, this is anukirtanam. The kirtanam was done by Sri Krishna. Then it was done by Vyasa, who recorded all these teachings. And now it's being done by me. And my teaching then is anukirtanam. And this is a specific practice for the sake of cultivating bhakti. Reading those stories is a practice, number one. Number two is reflecting on those stories. Anukirtanam is number two. And then what is number three? Parinishtacha pujayam. Parinishta, being established in what? Pujayam, in the performance of some kind of worship. Some kind of worship doesn't necessarily mean puja like we did today. That puja is lovely, and there's so much symbolism. It's just rich, and it's wonderful. And if that form of worship appeals to you, excellent. If that form of worship doesn't appeal to you, that's okay. Remember, in this tradition, it's not you must do this. We've discussed many times this principle of adhikari bheda, the fact that the Hindu tradition embraces the diversity of us all and then prescribes different practices for different people, which is why if Sri Krishna were here, what would he say in Hindi? Ye bhi, TK. That this is also okay. That's a nice way of describing these teachings. It's okay. If you like to do it like this, it's okay. If you like to do it like that, it's okay. But you have to do something. So if you don't like to do, if you aren't inclined to this kind of worship, by the way, many of our friends, and some of you, I have a feeling, some of you were raised in this Arya Samaj tradition. And those of you and your friends who were raised in that tradition are not so inclined for this kind of puja. They are inclined, however, for doing some havan, homa. Wonderful. So if you don't like to do puja like this, then do worship like that. And if you don't like to do worship like that, do it in some other form, but do it. Is a point. Some kind of worship. Now, suppose someone says, oh, Swamiji, I'm not inclined for any of that. Well, we need to think a little bit more deeply. And one thread we're going to see in all of his instructions is that puja, worship, is not necessarily of a deity on the altar, not necessarily a deity up in the heavens. By the way, the symbolism of heaven is your oblations are consumed and the flames and smoke carry your oblations up. So in puja, we worship deity on the heaven. I'm sorry. In puja, we worship a deity on the altar. Through heaven, you worship a deity in the heavens. There are other ways of worshiping that deity. On the altar, in the heavens, what would be a good third place? Inside of other people. To help someone with the understanding that that person is an embodiment of the divine. Thank you. To help someone with that understanding that that person is an embodiment of the divine, that's called puja. Why not? You can worship deity on the altar. You can worship a deity up in the heavens. You can worship the deity in each person. And what's wonderful is you get to choose. And if you can think of a fourth or fifth way, fine. Any form of worship is acceptable. And that's what it says here, some kind of puja. So, and parinishtha, being established in that puja, doing it consistently. That's third. Then fourth, very practical advice, tuti bihi stavanam mama. Stavanam, praise. Mama, praise of me. Stuti bihi, with hymns of praise, some form of prayer. What form of prayer? I'm smiling. I'm thinking about Puja Swamiji. He says, you know, if what kind of prayer should? First of all, any prayer you say is a good prayer in any language. You can pray without words. Ever think of that? Prayers need not be in the form of words. Can you love someone without words? Why not? Can you feel appreciation? Can you feel gratitude without words? Obviously. You get my point? Prayers don't even need to be in the form of words. Now comes my guru's joke. He says, of course, if you are praying, you know, it's like when you're speaking to someone, it's best if you speak in their native language, their matribhasha. So we can speak to you in English, but if your mother tongue is Hindi or Tamil or whatever, it might be a little, and your friend happens to share your same mother tongue, then it's more a little deeper conversation when you speak in your mother tongue. So my guru observes, if you're going to pray, then it might be advantageous to pray in Ishvara's Matrabhasha. God has a mother tongue? I said, yeah, Sanskrit. It's a joke. Don't take it seriously. So if you pray to Ishvara in English, he'll say in Sanskrit, I don't understand. Okay, you get my point. It's a joke. But not a joke for you. Doesn't even need to be in the form of words. But some kind of prayer is mandatory. By the way, a good definition of prayer, we just ruled out words, right? So then how to define prayer? If prayer is not necessarily in a form of words, then how shall we define it? Here's one definition. Prayer is an act of relating to Ishvara. I like that definition. Any way in which you relate to Ishvara, any way in which you appreciate your relationship to Ishvara is a form of prayer. With words, without words, in Hindi, Tamil, English, Sanskrit, any language. Okay, let's continue. Adara paricharyayam, adara paricharyayam, sarvangarhavivandanam, sarvangarhavivandanam, madbhakta puja bhyadhika, madbhakta puja bhyadhika, sarvabhuteshu manmatihi, sarvabhuteshu manmatihi. Adaraha, literally having respect for, doesn't work here. Just being engaged in. Being engaged in what? Paricharyayam, in service. Being engaged in service. And being engaged in the service doesn't necessarily mean doing volunteer work at the ashram, at a temple, or something else. It means serving Ishvara in any way, and perhaps most importantly, Ishvara's presence, Sri Krishna's presence in people. And I think the most obvious example of this paricharya, the service to others, is to your own immediate family. That comes first. Take care of your family. Take care of them and everyone in your family. That comes first. Then you can imagine it in circles. First you take care of your immediate family, then extended family, then friends, and you can think of circles. So we can expand that service as much as you can. You know, to the extent you can, you serve all those around you. That's four, five. Number six in his list, sarva angaihi abhivandanam. Abhivandanam means prayer, worship, but here, abhivandanam, prayer, worship, sarvangaihi, with all of your limbs. And how do you worship with all of your limbs? Shashtanga namaskaram. Nam literally means to bend. So namaskara or namaste means it has that sense of bowing. Bowing with humility, bowing with respect. And here, sarva angaihi, all your limbs. So eight. What are just for fun, what are those eight? You can actually find various interpretations, but here's a common interpretation. So if you're stretched out like this, by the way, it's usually said that men only are supposed to do this. I don't know why, but that is what's generally taught. First, hands. Then what? Elbows, two. Forehead is three. Body is four. Did I miss? I'm missing one. Yeah, yeah. So hands, one. Hands, arms, elbows, two. Forehead is three. Body is four. There we go. Knees is five. And feet is six. That's ashta. No, that's Shashta, not Ashta. That's six. We need eight. So they add in, if you're bowing down like that and you're thinking about what you have to do when you get home tonight. So it should include your mind. And if you're bowing down like that and you say out loud, why am I doing this? Speech. So there's six parts of your body plus speech and mind. This is a common way of how to get eight limbs. Otherwise, hey, there are other ways of counting, but this is a kind of a tradition. This is a convention. So bowing, and of course that bowing, as I said, with your mind. Just throwing your body down on the ground is not namaskaram. Comes from here. Which also means you don't have to throw your body down on the ground if it comes from here. All right. Mad bhakta puja abhyadika. Better to take the last one. Sarva bhuteshu manmatihi. Having manmati. Man is the pronoun me. Manmati, having the feel, having the mati, the conclusion, the recognition that me, Sri Krishna, I am sarva bhuteshu in all beings. Recognizing my presence in all beings. People criticize religion as being somehow disengaged from worldly difficulties. All religions can sometimes suffer from this problem, where religious practice becomes what you do inside the temple. But what is Sri Krishna saying here? He's saying, I'm not hearing the sound. He's saying that religious practice is not merely what goes on in the temple. Religious practice is what goes on in your daily lives when you're relating to any other person, recognizing that person as an embodiment of the divine. And that leads to the last one here, mad bhakta puja abhyadika. The puja, worship, devotion to mad bhakta, those who are devoted to me, abhyadika, extremely devoted to me. I wouldn't say worship here. Puja means worship, but here's the problem: if you worship those who are the literal meaning, the worship of those who are most devoted to me. That's a literal translation. What would be the problem with that literal translation? Worship of those, I'll add a word which will make it clear. Worship of those people who are most devoted to me. Worship of those human beings who are most devoted to me. Worship of those flawed human beings. Well, you're getting it. Oh. Worship of those flawed human beings who are most devoted to me. We don't worship human beings. You can worship the divinity within. Don't worship the human being. Clear. No matter how saintly a person is, they do not qualify for worship. Respect. Obedience, whatever, you know, depending on your relationship. Absolutely. Love and respect for these human beings. Worship we reserve for Ishvara. Okay. Actually, this is probably a good place to stop. We've covered only eight of these very practical ways of cultivating bhakti. So when we meet next week, we'll see more of these ways in which bhakti can be cultivated. Announcements, simply, we have our Vedanta class tomorrow at 10 o'clock, followed by satsang at 11. Come with your questions, and we'll conclude the day with our prayers at the altar. Is there? I'm just noticing a lot of people. I'm hoping there's nothing wrong out there. That is my concern. Om Gananahan Twa Ganapatigamavamahe Kavingavinam Upamashravastamam Jeshtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspatahana Shrinvan Utibisida Sadhanam Om Mahaganapataye Namaha Ishvaro Guru Rathmeti Murti Bheda Vibhagine Vyomavad Vyapta Dehaya Dakshina Murtaye Namaha Vasudeva Sutam Devam Kamsachanuramardhanam Devaki Paramanandam Krishnam Vande Jagat Gurum Om Sarve Bhavantu Sukhinaha Sarve Santu Niramayaha Sarve Bhadrani Pashyantu Ma Kashchid Dukha Bhagbhavet Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityor Ma Amritangamaya Om Shanti 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 Om Tat Sat. Oh.